Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through the underwriting by Joan Gellard Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. According to a Justice Department survey, more than 1 million women are stalked annually in the U.S., and about 1 out of every 12 women will be stalked sometime in their lifetime. Of these, college-age females, 18 to 29, are at the highest risk. Internet predators and technology-facilitated crimes such as cyberstalking, sextortation, and revenge porn are among emerging issues and the topic of today's show. Tracy Webb, Los Angeles Deputy City Attorney and Counselor for Child Abuse Policy and Cybercrime Prosecution, is joining us by phone today. And Christina Caviani, Director of the SAFER Program at Cal Poly, a confidential advocacy, education, and support resource for addressing sexual assault, sexual misconduct, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking, is also here with me. Our show is live today, and we invite you to join our conversation with your comments and questions. You can do that by calling us at 781-3875. Again, that's 805 area code, 781-3875. And Tracy and Christina, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, so in getting started, you know, this kind of opens just a whole nother era of vulnerability of people, and Tracy, this really isn't limited to just our kids today, is it?
No, unfortunately, it's not. When you start talking about the width and breadth of cyberspace, it goes all demographics, down from the littlest kids playing on mom and dad's tablet to seniors who are incredibly vulnerable. So it's quite a big issue.
Now, how long has the cybercrime? How long have you been prosecuting cybercrime?
In one way, shape, or form, we've been prosecuting that, for 20-some-odd years since the Internet was invented, if you will. Mm-hmm. But from a task force standpoint, I've been doing it for a little bit over 9 years. Okay. In the Southern California area.
And you're seeing an emerging problem in this area? Are you seeing more cases being brought before you?
Well, I definitely have job security. There's no doubt about that.
It's unfortunate.
But, I think what has happened over time is we've seen an evolution of the different types of crimes. Mm-hmm. We still have the predators. They're not going to go away anytime soon. But different types of crimes have come up as technology has evolved, as technology has progressed, as the use of smartphones has become so widespread, and the incredible ease with which people can create apps for good and also for bad.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the apps, because, I think Facebook is an app that people are readily familiar with because it's been around for such a long time, and it's probably a familiar name. But there are a lot of apps now that maybe are less familiar. Can you talk a little bit about those?
How many hours do you have, Chris? There are a lot of apps. When we talk about things like Facebook and Instagram, we're sort of talking about those as social networking sites,
right,
and ways that people can, interact with one another socially.
Uh-huh.
And years ago, and I'm talking about maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, when we first saw the emerging use of Facebook and other social networking sites, they really were standalone sites, where you would go to Facebook and you would be on Facebook, and you would have Facebook friends and you would share things on Facebook with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had things like Twitter come up and Instagram come up, and those two were standalone social networking sites or standalone apps that people were using. But what we've seen in the last couple of years is connectivity. And so now, instead of them being standalone sites or standalone apps, they're all connected to each other. And so it's decreased our privacy, obviously, and increased our vulnerability, because you may sign into Facebook and post something to share with your Facebook friends, but unbeknownst to you, the user, it may also be shared on your friend's Twitter site and on your friend's LinkedIn site and on your friend's Instagram site. And so it becomes a connectivity issue where everything's connected to everything else.
And you have no control over that?
No. no control over it. You have control over your privacy settings,
uh-huh.
and you have control over how you set your privacy settings, but none of them are going to be 100%. And as we've seen in the news even the last couple of days, privacy isn't what it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's even being challenged more, right? And,
sure.
And I think you're talking about the cell phone privacy through Apple, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so you have the issue between law enforcement and the social networking sites who are protecting ostensibly the privacy rights of their users.
Yeah, I was doing some research and background for today's show, I happened to get onto my granddaughter's onto her Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and she had decided to reset her settings, her privacy settings, and she was amazed how many requests she was getting every day since she changed the settings in the last week for friending from people she had no knowledge of. And it was clear to her that these are people that had been following her through the fact that her setting had been too open with friends of friends being able to follow her.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of was eye-opening to me as well, too.
And that happens quite frequently, and mm-hmm. it increases vulnerability of not just children, but adults and seniors as well. And
mm-hmm.
what most people don't realize about those privacy settings is you have to keep checking them.
Yeah.
Because the way the social networking sites are set up, the default privacy settings are the lowest, the most open, the public settings. And so it may be that as you're using it and not checking your sites, for one reason or another, because of updates and the way the social networking sites work, your privacy settings may have defaulted down to the lowest without you even knowing.
Wow.
So it's that diligence that we have to have where we check and recheck.
So talk a little bit about what cyber stalking is, if people who are listening don't understand that or really haven't experienced that.
Well, hopefully none of your listeners have experienced
hopefully.
It. That would be all of our hope. But the idea of stalking is taking the concept of stalking as we would think of it in a traditional sense, meaning somebody following you, paying attention to where you go, showing up where you are at your home or your place of work or your school, but taking it to the 21st century technology level where there are apps that have been created for the specific purpose of stalking people. So they will tap into the, in a very generic sense, they will tap into the GPS ability of all of our smartphones and be able to keep track of where you are, where you go, what you do, by using the technology within that app and the GPS. So all they really need is your cell phone number,
mm-hmm.
and they can figure out where you are, where you're going, what your patterns are.
Where you're located if you have your cell phone with you,
exactly.
You mean?
Where your cell phone is, not necessarily. And we all know that most people these days never go anywhere without their cell phones.
And why would somebody do that, Tracy?
That is the million-dollar question that keeps me in business as a prosecutor.
And what do you see are reasons for your prosecution? I mean, you must see that there are some cases that you go, okay, well, why would this happen?
Sure. I mean, that's in our heads, I think, all the time from a law enforcement perspective, from a victim support perspective, is you just kind of want to shake your head and say, why would you do that? It's kind of the same way with any kind of a crime. Why would somebody commit a crime? Whether
mm-hmm.
it's evil intent, whether it's a domestic violence situation,
right.
Where there's control and issues having to do with that. So it kind of depends upon the person, and I think each case that we handle is slightly different.
Mm-hmm. So this is, if we were to look at it from a domestic violence or a dominance kind of a situation,
mm-hmm.
it could have been that in years and years ago it was the same as taking the car keys and someone not having access to a vehicle,
sure,
or
sure.
not being able to lock their house and leave because they would have everything potentially robbed. So now it's really being able to track your whereabouts all of the time and stalking you that way.
Right. And I mean, the basis of technology these days for all of us is that it's 24/7. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to use technology is, all day, every day, 365 days a year. And so if you look at the traditional domestic violence model of power and control, then what better way to exert power and control over your intimate partner than by keeping track of them using the technology that they use every day?
And is it more often that males or females will do this, or do you find that it's doesn't really matter?
You know, I think
on
if
the
you
sex?
Looked at the statistics, you would see there tend to be more male perpetrators rather than female, but we see both. We definitely see both.
And when I was reading the statistics at the beginning of the show for the cyber stalking, the age group of 18 to 29, does that seem to fit?
Yes, as the most vulnerable, yes.
Okay. And how about for seniors? What do you see as an area in kind of cyber that they're most vulnerable?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you think of technology and stalking as we're talking about, you don't necessarily think of that senior population. But, you know, we have domestic violence in the senior population.
Right.
So it's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have quite as widespread a use of smartphones as the younger demographic has. But I think with the senior population, what we're seeing as far as vulnerability is fraud. And the increased use of technology and computer technology by seniors, and because of that, them falling prey to people who are perpetrating frauds against them.
Okay, through their computers.
Yes.
Okay. Would that be like the person that wants to fix that problem with your computer remotely?
Exactly. Those kinds of things. Almost the similar things that we've seen traditionally in the past with the telephone, where they'll, they'll call up and make an offer to fix your roof or, mm-hmm. you know, to refinance your car or, mm-hmm. or to fix your computer. And, you know, I can make your computer go that much faster, or I can stop all those pop-ups if you just, you know, wire me $300.
So with all of the apps that are readily available that you don't know have connected you,
mm-hmm.
is there anything you can do to prevent that, to shut that down?
Well, I mean, a little bit. Obviously, awareness and educating yourself, especially when you're talking about the senior population, because one of the, go back a second and answer your question, another crime that we're seeing to an increasing amount against seniors is with the use of computers and email and text messages, those emails that we've probably all seen where your granddaughter contacts you, or your grandson contacts you and says, I've lost my wallet in London.
Yeah.
Please wire me money. Mm-hmm. And you would be shocked at the number of people who do, because they fall prey to, oh my gosh, I have to help my loved one. I have to help my daughter or my granddaughter or my grandson.
Yeah.
And so being aware that those scams are out there, mm-hmm. is probably the number one most important thing to educate people about. And then obviously the antivirus software and the anti-malware software that the security companies provide are a must these days for smartphones and for computers.
And Christina, with SAFER program at Cal Poly, is cyber stalking something that you're involved in also educating about at the Cal Poly campus? Is it something that you're seeing with Cal Poly students?
Yeah, definitely seeing more and more stalking, and then, just the normal stalking that we think about with someone in person. But then we've seen a lot more cyber stalking, and that's why in January, which January is National Stalking Awareness Month, we brought Tracy to Cal Poly because we were seeing it happening so often that we wanted to make sure we were informing as many people as possible. So, I'm not sure, how our law enforcement, how they're trained on this topic. And I know that we're trying to make sure that students just know their rights and know that this is a crime. They have resources. They can come talk to SAFER as a confidential resource. But we also, as a university, have a process to make a report as well. So that we're just making sure that information is out there readily as possible.
Tracy, that's a really good, it brings up a good point. What is, you know, the law's position on this? Is it that a crime has to actually be committed? Can they get involved with something as it's occurring?
Well, it's a good question, and obviously it's an ever-evolving answer from day to day as technology and the law evolves and as the law tries to keep up with the technology. But depending on the community, I mean, most communities, most jurisdictions in the United States now have an ICAC task force, which has to do with crimes against children. Internet crimes against children is what it stands for. And so they are involved in both proactive and reactive prosecutions, but also in education and the education component.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that area, and then, you know, there are a lot of jurisdictions. I know the California Attorney General has an outreach project and various other law enforcement agencies who will go out to schools and to churches and to community organizations and to colleges and try and sort of do the education awareness piece so that they prevent the crime before it happens.
Right.
But in situations like I think you're asking about, where maybe something's happened, maybe
right.
somebody has a stalking app, or somebody seems to be showing up places that they shouldn't be, and things
and
like that.
And it's an adult.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you can certainly involve law enforcement, and they might be able to, you know, nip it in the bud before it becomes a crime. It just depends on the situation.
Have you seen them do anything?
Seen law enforcement do anything as far as stopping crimes before they happen?
Yeah, getting involved and being, okay.
I primarily do crimes against children, so I certainly see it more often in that.
Yeah.
But I have seen it when we've worked with the senior population, and I've seen a lot of different jurisdictions step in and do some prevention efforts.
Okay. If you just joined us, you're listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX, your public radio station. If the idea of cyber stalking doesn't concern you, it should. It's one of the topics of our show today, and it can address how anyone, adult or child, teen, using social media, internet, smartphones, are at risk and need to be alert for exposure and exploitation that comes with advancing technology. My guests today are Tracy Webb, who's the Los Angeles Deputy City Attorney and Counselor for Child Abuse Policy and Cybercrime Prosecution, and Tracy is joining us by telephone, and Christina Caviani, who's the Director of the SAFER Program at Cal Poly, a confidential advocacy, education, and support resource that addresses sexual assault, misconduct, and dating violence. And stalking, our show is live, and we welcome your questions and comments, and we welcome you to be a part of this discussion today. You can call us at 781-3875. And I'm going to move on to another term that, if you could give me a definition of sextortion. What, Tracy, is sextortion?
Sextortion is probably the latest and greatest and newest crime that we're having to deal with as it relates to technology crimes these days, if you will. It's basically the idea of using threats or enticement online to coerce a person to provide sexually explicit photos or videos. And so, sort of in a nutshell, that's what it is. So it's kind of the same idea as old-fashioned extortion, where you would try and get money out of someone. But instead of trying to get, trick somebody or using threats or enticement to get money out of somebody, they're trying to get sexually explicit photos or videos.
And then are those photos and videos used later on for extortion?
Yes, what they usually do is you'll have a typical sextortionist, if you will, make a demand for, you know, some kind of sexually explicit photo or video, and then the person will either send them to them, hoping that they will go away, which they usually don't, by the way,
right.
And then demand more, or threaten to reveal them in ways nobody would want to be revealed. In other words, taking those photos that they have and sending them out to their contact list, to their
publicly.
Place of employment, to their friends, to their family members, and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. How common is this becoming? Is it growing?
It's really growing, and it's grown by leaps and bounds, I'm sorry to say, in the last couple of years, because, you know, smartphone technology has been has increased so much in the last couple of years, and people have have and probably continue to not realize how much privacy they don't have in the saving of their pictures. And that, coupled with the fact that we've seen an increased use and misuse, if you will, of malware, which is malicious software that allows the sextortionist access to your computer.
Is it also coupled by the fact that a lot of people are saving their photos to clouds?
Sure. I mean, you know, to some extent, but most people, I think, in most of the cases that we're seeing, are just saved to smartphones or computers.
Oh, okay. So it's right there.
Right.
Okay.
It's right there. And then what happens is if the people get malware on their computer through some of those phishing emails that we're also familiar with, they'll click on a link. It doesn't take them anywhere except to put malware in their computer. And then what that malware does is it gives the sextortionist, if you will, the malware bad guy, I sometimes call them, complete access to your computer.
Explain for people who don't know what phishing is. Can you explain that, please, and how that works?
Sure. Phishing is sort of become kind of a common term. It's phishing with a PH and not phishing with a fishing pole on a lake. But it's the idea that many, many of us, if not all of us, have seen them, where you get an email, say, from Google or from Verizon or from some company or from your bank that says, click on this link. We just want to help you update your settings to give you the best service we can possibly provide, or whatever they say. And most people think, oh, well, I'm a good bank customer. I'm going to click here and update my settings for them. Mm-hmm. And none of those emails these days are real, because every reputable company and internet service provider has realized that there's such an increased prevalence of these fake emails, if you will, out there, that none of them are sending them anymore. So chances are pretty good if anybody's getting one of those emails, it's not real.
Right.
And we're also seeing an increased number of emails that say you won something, you won a free prize, you won a free iPad, you won some amount of money or something. And kids especially, but seniors and others fall prey to this. Everybody loves free stuff. So they think, oh, I'm going to claim my free iPad, not realizing that it's simply a trick and device to get you to click on a link that will put the malware into your computer.
And in fairness, a lot of these are very sophisticated and look very close to genuine.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, a couple of years ago, if we were talking about this, I would probably say to you and your listeners, look at the address, look at the email, look at the URL, and it's going to look funny. It's going to look weird, and it's going to be a red flag.
Now
not so. Now we're seeing them with Apple.com. My daughter got one that was IRS.gov, offering her, you know, a tax refund. And so they do look real. And so now they're incredibly sophisticated. And the problem is, if you accidentally click on one of those links, and many, many, many people do, thinking that they're real, what it does is it gives the person who sent the malware bad guy, complete unfettered access to your computer. And not like a virus where your computer acts weird and you know it's there. The computer acts exactly the way it's supposed to act. Nothing seems afoot. But what they have is the same ability to access anything on your computer that you do. So they can see all your files, all your emails, all your pictures, all your searches. They can log your keystrokes. They can turn on your webcam. Anything you can do on the computer, they can do. So it becomes incredibly dangerous for not just sextortion crime purposes, but for other reasons, because they obviously can see into your life.
Yeah, and it is not unrealistic for someone to get in and turn your camera on your computer and be able to track you that way either.
Oh, no, absolutely not. They can turn your camera on your smartphone or your camera on your laptop or your desktop computer, and sometimes take pictures. You know, we've had, you know, many pictures of, you know, pictures that were taken of people getting dressed, getting out of the shower, paying their bills, you know, whatever it is they're doing. And then they have those pictures to then utilize however they choose.
Now, how are victims targeted for the sextortion?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Sometimes they're targeted by people who know they have pictures. Or suspect that they have pictures. Sometimes celebrities, you've probably heard in the news, you know, a number of celebrities.
Right.
Miss Teen USA a couple of years ago fell victim to sextortion, probably because she was a celebrity of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes it's random. And so that's the kind of the what breeds the uncertainty of all these things, is you don't really know if you're going to be victimized or not.
Now, I was fascinated to read that organized crime groups are starting to get involved in this particular area of crime as well.
Yes, we're seeing an increase in organized crime groups and also criminal street gangs getting involved as well.
And we're talking about some decent money, right? We're
not. Oh, absolutely. Decent money, tax-free.
Wow. And are there countries that are more at risk right now for cyber crimes, or is it pretty much worldwide? I mean,
it's pretty much worldwide. I mean, there are certainly countries where we don't have either jurisdiction or diplomatic relations who are sort of behind a lot of these apps and websites that are what we would consider illegal. But it's definitely a worldwide problem. We're definitely seeing it. Part of our global alliance interfaces with law enforcement agencies all over the world. And we're seeing it worldwide, unfortunately, because it's the World Wide Web.
So now, if somebody clicked onto a link that was phishing, mm-hmm. and somehow got linked in with this, and say somebody got into their files and got their photos, or if they suspected that maybe they'd been targeted, what should they do?
Well, they should call law enforcement, first of all, if they suspect that they have somehow been targeted and they have reason to believe that, especially if they've gotten some kind of a message.
Okay.
That makes them feel like they've been either compromised or they feel vulnerable.
So they should call their police department?
Absolutely, and ask for whatever detective is in charge of their cyber investigations.
And is there a detective in charge of cyber crimes in each department now?
There usually is.
Okay.
There's usually most departments, especially the larger departments, will have either an ICAC task force, which does the cyber crimes against children, and then they'll have a high-tech crimes division, and they call it by various names, obviously.
Yeah.
But if you ask for either the high-tech or the cyber crimes detective, they can usually point you in the right direction. And then, obviously, in a proactive way, people can make sure that the security software that they have on their computer includes anti-malware software, which not all of them do right now, but most of them are adding it.
Okay. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio station at 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas de Paso Robles, and 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org. The Justice Department defines cyberstalking as the use of technology to stalk victims. It shares many of the same characteristics as real-life stalking, which, like domestic violence, is a crime of power and control. While cyberstalking does not involve physical contact with a victim, it is still a serious crime. Cyberstalking, sextortion, revenge porn are part of today's discussion, and my guests to provide their professional expertise on the topics are Tracy Webb, Los Angeles Deputy City Attorney and Counselor for Child Abuse Policy and Cybercrime Prosecution, who has joined us by phone, and Christina Caviani, who's the Director of the SAFER Program at Cal Poly. What are your thoughts about today's topic or questions, or maybe you have a situation that has occurred for you? If you have been a victim of a cybercrime, you can reach us at 781-3875 and join our conversation today. Again, that's 781-3875. And I'm going to move on to, the topic of revenge porn, because the name kind of implies what that's about, but I'm going to let you, Tracy, kind of give us a little bit more of a definition around what that is and how that occurs.
Well, another fairly new phenomenon with the advent of the increased use of technology, what we're seeing in the area of revenge porn is kind of, as you said, exactly what it says. You will have a couple, boyfriend and girlfriend, some kind of a dating situation or marriage situation, and then the relationship ends,
mm-hmm.
and so one or the other will want to take revenge, not a new idea, but old idea, obviously, but using technology, take revenge, using technology to get back or hurt or harm that person or their reputation. And so there are various websites and apps that have been created for the specific purpose of allowing people to take, say, sexually explicit photos or information and post them on these sites for the purpose of exacting that revenge.
So there are actual websites for this?
There are. There are. There are. I mean, obviously, there, you know, there are a certain number of people who might use the traditional social networking sites like, you know, Facebook or Instagram and things like that. Usually those sites are very good at identifying especially explicit photos and taking them down immediately.
Right.
But sometimes not fast enough. And then there are other websites and apps that were created specifically for the purpose. One of them, many of your listeners may be familiar with, called You Got Posted, which came up in a large prosecution down in San Diego a while back, where somebody posted a lot of very explicit photos on that website for the purpose of exacting the revenge. There's also one called My Ex Get Revenge, another one called Hamster, various other apps that are out there and popping up every day that literally were created to facilitate the use of exacting revenge this way.
And there's really nothing, I mean, these apps are legal.
Well, I mean, legal is an interesting term. Probably an entire show talking about, you know, the legality because of the whole issues of privacy. But, you know, people can create apps and put them out there for sale. And because of the Constitution, because of the First Amendment, because of the rights that we all hold dear in our country, you know, we have no choice but to let them exist. Or more often with these websites, they're based somewhere else where we don't have jurisdiction to do anything about them, and they're out there on the web because the web is, as we know, worldwide.
So if someone were to take photos, post them against the will and against the permission of someone else for the distinct reason to embarrass, humiliate, and harm them, is that prosecutable?
It is, as of last year. There's a brand new in California and a number of other states, but in California specifically, there's actually a fairly new revenge porn statute that makes it a crime to do what I just described. So that's the good news. And there have been a fair share of prosecutions in the last many months since the law went into effect. So that's the good news.
Now, with that, though, people need to come forward and they need to report that, correct?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, as soon as they realized what's happening, it's usually because somebody sees it, somebody tells them they see it, notify law enforcement immediately.
What do you see, you know, we've talked about cyberbullying, and I think my co-host did a show not too long ago about cyberbullying, and we've heard over the last 5 or 6 years in particular kind of the cost to people of cyberbullying. What kind of impact is this having on people's lives? What are you seeing?
Well, I mean, I think the victimization and then re-victimization of of people who are victimized by this is incredible, and it's not something that is an isolated, you know, punch in the nose and
right.
then it heals. These are the kinds of crimes and the kinds of victimizations that literally, I mean, it sounds weird, but last a lifetime.
You can't get these down, right?
You can't get them down. You can't get them back. You can't erase them. You can't remove them from cyberspace, if you will. And the problem is you never know from day to day, minute to minute, when they're going to show up again. And so anything that's posted online, anything that's put out there, we see victimization. I mean, I've seen cases from 20, 25 years ago of children who were victimized.
Mm-hmm.
And the pictures keep showing up, and they keep getting posted and traded and reposted and retraded. And so the victimization and the effects on victims is really, really incredibly harmful.
What, if someone has become a victim of cyber stalking or is going through a bad breakup, especially given the exposure that we have now with this technology, what What do you direct people to do to protect themselves?
It's a great question and also a really hard question to answer because, you know, one of the obvious things is don't take those pictures. You know, a lot of these times we have pictures who, you know, people in a committed relationship who are just taking pictures just to share with each other because they're in love and they're going to stay together forever.
Right.
And which is all fine and good until you're not together anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the kind of the logical thing, and I'd be kind of interested to hear from sort of Christina's perspective from the college age, demographic. But, you know, the big takeaway is don't take those pictures, because if you don't have the pictures out there, then they're not going to, you know, hurt you later. And also just be really aware and really diligent about your passwords and not sharing your passwords and changing your passwords frequently, as annoying as that is, and really keeping very close watch on your social networking sites.
And Christina, do you want to jump in about what your take is, what the feedback is from the college community?
Yeah, I mean, we don't hear very often about photos, but a lot of monitoring of people's whereabouts, wanting to take photos. You know, if you're in a relationship, a partner's asking, you know, will you take photos of where you are so I know where you are? So monitoring all of their Facebook and all their social media. And so there's the feeling of they're constantly being watched and monitored. And there's, you know, the power and control over them. And so we're seeing that being a piece of, you know, the whole violence piece. We're seeing a lot of students, almost every student uses Yik Yak, which is a really popular app.
And what's the benefit of using Yik Yak?
Well, you can anonymously, or, you know, so people think, anonymously write your comments, whatever you want. So, and we, you know, staff and faculty at Cal Poly that are kind of privy to it will go on there and see what's going on, because you see what's the haps with the students. And it's geographically sensitive. So it's, you know, within a certain range, Yik Yak's overseeing students that are, it's not only students, but at you know, in this area, it's heavily used by Cal Poly students and probably Cuesta students as well. It's an opportunity to say whatever you want and have people, you know, give it a thumbs up or thumbs down. It's not the icon is thumbs up or thumbs down, but similar idea. And yeah, so it's kind of that idea that you can put yourself out there and not have any repercussions. We know that students use Snapchat, and we know that that's something that we hear a lot about with those two specifically. And I think that students don't identify it as a problem, so that's why we're trying to make sure that people know that this isn't just, it's not okay to feel like your partner is asking you for your passwords, you know, or for, you know, you to be monitored, or for you to feel like, you know, that your privacy is being taken from you. So it's been made into kind of like, you know, the idea of Facebook stalk. You know, we've used that word so nonchalantly, and people do use the word stalking all the time. You know, if you hear people will say like, oh yeah, you know, I'm stalking you, and it's joking. So when it actually is legitimate stalking, or at least something that we're very concerned about, we hear people really minimize it. Students will come and say, you know, this person's keeps, you know, coming to the library at the same time as me, and I've asked them to not bother me anymore. It's not a big deal. And it's like, wait. You know, you've asked them to not bother you, and they keep showing up at the same time. That isn't right, you know, and so we want to make sure students know, you know, what is right and what's wrong, and what they, you know, where they can go. Just removing barriers for all types of situations where they're feeling uncomfortable and unsafe.
How does security or the campus police get involved when there are cyber issues, or do they?
They certainly would.
Okay.
Yeah, UPD is University Police at Cal Poly. They're fantastic. I encourage students to utilize them all the time. Their officers and their detectives are wonderful, so I'm always encouraging that. We just got a new chief for SLO PD,
right.
And I know she's extremely committed to this topic as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think just knowing that everyone always has the right, if they're even in question, if their gut is telling them this is off, something's wrong, to call law enforcement, you know, and if they say, you know, this isn't a crime or this isn't a big, I mean, which I have never had happen. You know, if you're at the point where you're thinking, should I call law enforcement? Most of the time you really just should. Mm-hmm.
If you're alarmed enough to consider that.
Right, yeah. Right. Because people wait so long to get to the point of thinking, should I? Because they're scared of going to the police, you know. And so we want to humanize the officers and detectives as much as we can so that they know this process is for them. And to help them feel safe, especially students that are walking around campus, if there's so much going on for them, then if they have to worry about being cyber stalked as well or being involved in domestic violence, dating violence, anything, that's you know, they have a limit of how they can mm-hmm. keep thriving, and that becomes really a huge barrier to them staying at Cal Poly, thriving at Cal Poly. So we work really closely with them, and Safer provides advocacy. So we walk them to wherever they need to go and kind of walk them through the process and encourage them that it's okay. If you feel like something's wrong, let's see what we can do, you know, like mm-hmm. let's make the situation better than it is, and empower you to know information. A lot of students aren't technology literate, you know, and so they're students and they have been raised with technology, but that doesn't mean they've been aware of how to protect themselves or the vulnerability that is there, you know, so
right.
they, you know, there's all these other repercussions of the high amount of technology use that we can, you know, that's another show. But I think just getting the bare facts of, you know, what do you think is anonymous? What do you, you know, when you're sending emails and when you're doing this, like, you know, this just etiquette and information about how to use technology in a way that doesn't harm them.
You know, and one of the things, Tracy, that keeps popping into my mind is the idea that, you know, do you suggest that people do an internet search of themselves periodically?
Oh, absolutely.
To see what comes
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. Google yourself.
Yeah.
As often as you can.
Yeah.
And
to
and
see
then,
what comes up, because you may be surprised.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, a lot of people are surprised frequently. You can also do Google Alerts, which is, you know, really good for parents and really good for individuals as well.
And explain what that is.
Well, you could go on Google and you can set alerts. I mean, a lot of people do it for, like, you know, if they're into, you know, Middle Eastern cooking, then they'll
right.
do a Google alert and get recipes or things like that. But you can actually do it with you can go to Google Alerts. I think it says set alerts, and then you can type in your email address or your name or, you know, your city, you know, and you're going to get, obviously, if your name is John Smith, you're going to get a lot of Google alerts. But it will send you emails and information every time somebody either searches your name or something pops up on that particular subject matter. So, for instance, I have a Google alert on cybercrime. So every time there's any kind of a news story posted out there on the internet about cybercrime, I get a notification, and you can say, I want it once a day, I want it twice a day, I want it once a week, and things like that. So it's just one more little safeguard that people can put in place to protect themselves.
And, you know, it used to be that you didn't want to reveal your home address, but
right.
now it sounds like with the apps that you were talking about, that's not, I mean, of course you don't want to do that, but you don't necessarily have to put your home address on anything like your social media or your Facebook in order for people to find you.
Well, and, you know, that's becoming increasingly true with the, you know, increased sophistication of technology. Anybody out there who did the latest upgrade on an iPhone 6 will know that it will now tell you every time you turn your phone on or open up your phone, it will tell you how far you are from home and what the traffic is like to get there.
Right.
And the first time I saw that, I was like, how do you know where I live?
Yeah.
You know, except that they do, because they've built in of the ability, whether it's Apple or Android or whoever it happens to be, built in the ability to track where you go and what you do and where you go most often at certain times of the day. And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, we used to say, don't put your address in there, and now, you know, the cyberspace knows it anyway.
What about credit reports, checking those?
I mean, that's, you know, for financial reasons and for, you know, privacy and personal safety reasons, it's always a very good idea, because sometimes any of those things can alert you if something's amiss, and then you can investigate it further.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there was a movie years ago, I think, with Julia Roberts, where all of her identity was changed, mm-hmm. and that's not impossible to do these days, right?
No, it's not. There was another one called The Net with Sandra Bullock.
Right.
It was the same idea,
right?
Where, you know, the sort of this overwhelming, creepy feeling,
yeah.
that all your information is now known, and it's not that far-fetched these days, unfortunately.
And what about if you think that there's malware in your computer? I mean, what can you do about that? Take it to someone, or?
I mean, most of the security companies now, I know Avast has it. There's a free one called Malware Bytes that you can put on your computer, and what it will do is scan your computer, and if there's any malware in there, it will quarantine it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't necessarily take the malware out of your device, but it quarantines it so that nobody can access it. I'm pretty sure the only way you can get it out of the device is if you take it to a, you know, computer expert or Geek Squad or someplace like that, where they'll actually take it out. But you can certainly get anti-malware software that will quarantine it so nobody can access it on your computer, and every single one of us should have that.
And so do cyber stalkers get some kind of a rush, or is it a game?
It must be. It's, you know, it's all of us that are interested in that might, you know, would want to climb into somebody's brain and figure out why they do what they do. You know, and sometimes it's the power and control issue that we deal with in domestic violence situations, and sometimes it's just evil criminal intent. It just depends on the person.
You know, I have, when I raised my daughter, we didn't even have cell phones. I mean, I had one of the first cell phones that you still had to plug into your car. They were huge. They were mm-hmm. like these huge mm-hmm. suitcases. It's embarrassing. But so I didn't have to deal with that. I look at what my daughter has to deal with my grandchildren in mm-hmm. terms of their access to the internet and their cell phones mm-hmm. and the different apps mm-hmm. that she checks to be down. And the alarms that go off on her stuff so that, you know, they're running through her account if they download or trying mm-hmm. to download stuff that isn't okay. And I think, God, it's a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. You know, it's a very much a full-time job for parents. All of those things that they need to concern themselves with, and, you know, and also the neck issues of texting all the time, and the thumb issues that are probably going to arise from texting all the time, and whatever is happening to our eyes from the blue light that comes from the screens. It's there's a lot to think about for parents these days.
In the work that you're doing with, you know, the cyber crimes against children, Tracy, are you seeing an increase in grandparents that are raising children, and they're kind of a generation removed from this technology and trying to deal with all of this?
Sure, sometimes. I mean, and to some extent, parents and grandparents are both a generation removed from this. You know, we refer to children these days and teenagers, young adults, as digital natives. And, you know, they're being raised by people who were not raised in a digital society. And so it's a huge, big learning curve for parents, for grandparents, for any caregivers of children now. They really have to stay up on the technology. And sometimes I even recommend for these people to, especially for grandparents who are raising children, is try to get the kids to teach them. they're sometimes the best educators for us.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, what's that app on your phone? Can you teach me how that works? I don't understand this. Can you? And kids are usually really proud of how smart they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're sometimes very willing to, you know, help them navigate and teach them how things work. So a lot of our intel and our task force we get from kids who are willing to teach us things.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were out and you were talking at Cal Poly, what kind of messages, when you talk to that population, are you wanting to make sure that you're delivering? What is it that you think is really important for that population to hear?
I mean, I think kind of as Christina mentioned a little while ago, I think it's, you know, sort of the awareness of how advanced technology is and also the lack of privacy. Because I think one of the things that that Christina mentioned is the use of Snapchat and the use of Yik Yak and a lot of these chat apps. People, especially young people, college-age people, tend to really mistakenly rely on the perceived anonymity of those apps.
Right.
And so they believe that because Snapchat disappears after 10 seconds, that it's really gone,
yeah.
When in fact it's not. And they rely on the anonymity of something like Yik Yak, not realizing that you know, the person who you're texting with can see where you are on the GPS that's embedded in within the app. And so I think the sort of broadening their awareness and not relying so much on anonymity and privacy is probably the biggest message.
Yeah, yeah. And with that, how do you, you know, is it that they just need to, well, it can't even stay off of that and say that you're safe, right? Because if you're connected with friends that are using Yik Yak or Snapchat, they can share information that you've sent to them through another social media, correct?
Sure, especially because everything's connected now. And so the interesting thing about that is, you know, even if you yourself are safe and even if you yourself don't post anything inappropriate or don't
right.
put out any information now, if you think about all the connections that everyone has, that, you know, broadens the scope of your vulnerability, if you will. So if you have 100 friends on Facebook or 100 followers on Instagram, each of those 100 followers may have 100 other followers, and so on exponentially. So you're really opening yourself up to not only your world that you live within, but everybody else's extended world as well.
And employers now, even schools, when they're looking at individuals, are also looking at social media. They're doing searches,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
they can use that as a criteria, can they not?
Oh, absolutely. And why wouldn't they? I mean, if you think about from the standpoint of an admissions mm-hmm. office, you know, they want to fill their campus with the best and the brightest and those that will fit in the best at that campus. And so why rely on the words on an application or an essay when you can look at somebody's life through social media?
Right.
And so, yeah, across the country. And believe me, I've asked. And they're mm-hmm. doing it because mm-hmm. they can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the information about that individual may not be their inappropriate behavior in posting or even what they're saying. It could be information that's being put out about them from someone else.
Sure, sure. Or it could be just kids being silly.
Yeah.
You know, you just never
or
know.
Young.
I mean, we had a case where it was a private high school application where a child did not get into the private school because on Facebook, this is a couple years ago, he had joined the I Hate School Club. Well, it was just a joke. They were just goofing around. They were like, I wonder what the high school, you know, I Hate School Club. But the high school saw it and took it at face value and thought, well, if you hate school, we don't want you in our private high school. And so, you know, things like that, little things like that, that are seemingly, you know, silly little, you know, kids goofing off can sometimes come back to haunt you when you're talking about social media.
Now, you're also the adjunct professor at USC School of Social Work. Do you spend a lot of time talking about social media, about cyber?
You know, to some extent. I mean, to the extent that technology is almost affecting every part of our lives,
mm-hmm.
it comes into the, you know, the curriculum, whether we're talking about, you know, sexual assault on college campuses, whether we're talking about domestic violence, teen dating violence, the fact of technology and the part it plays in our lives comes into play all the time. You know, especially when you start talking about things like cyber stalking, which, you know, you cannot teach a domestic violence class on the college level or the master's level without addressing the issue of cyber stalking like we're talking about today.
Right. And for people who have Gmail accounts, that's also a vulnerability, isn't it?
Well, any kind of an email, any kind of an email account, any kind of a social networking site opens you up to vulnerability because they're connected to one another.
Yeah. Now, the good news, however, is in terms of stalking and some of the crimes that we're talking about that are done in a cyberspace, are they more trackable than when they're done in person?
To some extent, sure, they are, because everything tends to be connected to everything else, and you know, trackable sort of depends on what it is and where it is and what the circumstances are, especially in light of, you know, the questions of privacy that we're having to address in law enforcement right now. But yeah, I mean, everything you do online is permanent and forever, and so to that extent, certainly trackable.
So when you're giving guidance, you know, we have about 3 minutes to wrap up. What is it that you would, if you were to impart a couple of points, what are the key points that you'd want to walk away leaving?
Well, I think, you know, we've said the word awareness over the past hour a number of times, but I think awareness is really the key, and diligence as far as keeping track of what you're doing, what you're saying, what you're posting, what you're searching online, and keeping track of that on a very regular basis, whether it's keeping track of yourself and your children, your own behavior. But because of the privacy issues, because of the prevalence of connectivity in all of these sites, the best, you know, advice is to just really stay on it, really educate yourself, and really check and recheck your own behavior.
Well, and it almost sounds as though if we approach the fact like our computers and our cell phones in particular, are almost like a camera of our life that we're carrying around with us all the time.
Oh, absolutely. We're all creating these digital footprints that are just like fingerprints, and we create them and recreate them and add to them every day.
And if you're suspicious, if you think you're being victimized, not to ignore that.
Exactly, not to ignore that. And, you know, if you have just that gut feeling that you're being victimized or something just isn't right, you will rarely find a law enforcement officer who won't at least give some credence and at least look into it for you. They would much rather have you call than not call.
I want to, real quickly from you, Christina, SAFER is available for all students, male, female, at the Cal Poly campus.
And faculty and staff as well.
And faculty and staff as well.
And RISE for our county. So any community member who's been affected or has questions about this can call RISE 24/7.
Fantastic. I want to thank my guest today, Tracy Webb, Los Angeles Deputy City Attorney and Counselor for Child Abuse Policy and Cybercrime Protection, who joined us by phone. Christina Caviani, Director of the SAFER Program at Cal Poly. And Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX, and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. If you wonder what you should do if you find a baby bird or bat, join host Fred Monroe next week as he speaks with Claudia Duckworth and Virginia Flaherty from the Pacific Wildlife Care. And they'll talk about their vision of the community and response to wildlife and wildlife issues. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me today on Central Coast Voices.